Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, I'm talking with author Dave Cullen about the 25th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre.
Well, I think the anniversaries are a good time to just stop and take stock, because normally we're seeing things in isolation. And 10 years out, 20 years out, especially 25 years out, it's really good to step back and see, like, okay, what has this wrought?
Where are we now? What's changed? What hasn't? What should? Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This episode contains audio and descriptions depicting violence, as well as some harsh language. Please take care when listening. In the American West, land is life. Back in the 1800s, as the country expanded west, land was cheap. The federal government gave away hundreds of millions of acres of western land to anyone who wanted to homestead. But after over a century of giving the land away, there were still stretches of it out here that no one wanted to live on. Huge swaths of desert, sage-dotted badlands where farming was impossible. In 1976, a government agency called the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, took over most of this unwanted land and held it in the public trust. They would lease the land out for a fee, mostly to cattle ranchers and miners. And in Nevada, where more than half of state territory is managed by the BLM, a war over this land that no one wanted has raged ever since.
In the American West, it's an all-out brawl called the Sagebrush Rebellion, and the battle is threatening to turn very ugly.
When the BLM took control of these lands in 1976, a collection of ranchers, miners, and loggers, along with state and local officials, began to object to the new rules the federal government laid out about how that land should be used. And as those objections got louder and angrier, they became a movement that would be known as the Sagebrush Rebellion.
In the land of wide open spaces, there's a new land war. The federal government owns almost half the property in the West, and the fight is over who should control it.
The government set aside thousands of acres of public land for environmental purposes. For ranchers and miners, that meant less land to use and higher fees to use it. To these people, the government wasn't just protecting the environment. It was attacking the very foundation of the Western way of life. At first, the Sagebrush Rebellion was mostly a peaceful one. But in the early 90s, the sieges at Ruby Ridge and then Waco ignited embers of anti-government sentiment all across the country. The far-right militia movement was growing, and as it spread across the West, it found kinship with the anger of the Sagebrush Rebellion.
We have federal officials that are perverting the Constitution. The people are saying enough is enough.
Just months after Waco, someone threw a bomb onto the roof of the BLM headquarters in Reno. No one was killed, but the BLM office was destroyed, and a message had been sent. If the government continued to mess with local land, they would be met with violence.
A bomb went off in a U.S. Forest Service office in Carson City, Nevada.
One particular Forest Service worker in Carson City had both his office and his car blown up by pipe bombs, 4 months apart. All across the West, there were fistfights with government agents, death threats, and more bombings. And local officials were getting involved in the violence, too.
Dick Carver, a county supervisor, reopened a road in the Toyabe National Forest.
In July 1994, a Nevada county supervisor, mounted on a bulldozer, plowed through a forest preserve while hundreds of supporters cheered him on, some with guns on their hips.
Two federal rangers said they were threatened.
Carver later said of the Rangers, all it would have taken was for him to draw a weapon. 50 people with sidearms would have drilled him.
It was the 4th of July, and it became a declaration of independence for a new rebellion, this time from the feds.
As these standoffs over federal land intensified, the government was desperate to avoid another bloody ending like Waco, and they backed down. This widespread anti-government movement with the backing of patriot militias was emboldened. Ranchers in particular rebelled against federal agents. Some stopped paying their grazing fees altogether. daring the government to be stupid enough to come and seize their cattle. And for many years, the government laid off. But decades later, in the mid-2010s, a ranching family would come to prominence out of the ashes of the Sagebrush Rebellion. A family that would start a rebellion of its own with the help of militias from all over the country. A rebellion that would empower the far right like never before and alter the course of modern American history. I'm Garrett Graff, and this is Long Shadow, Rise of the American Far Right. Episode 5, A Call to Arms.
I think anyone who experiences life in the rural West knows that public lands sort of shape the conception of life out here. They are the vast majority of the land that you see when you drive through, and they are the way that most people interface with the federal government. Land becomes your vehicle for understanding how power works in the world.
This is James Pogue, a journalist and author of the book Chosen Country, A Rebellion in the West. The book focuses on a Mormon ranching family in Nevada that would become surprisingly consequential to American politics and the growth of the far right. The Bundys.
The Bundys have 160 acres of basically desert in southern Clark County, Nevada, not far from Las Vegas. They grow melons. They run a pretty small herd of cattle that they've bred themselves. Tough desert cattle that the Bundys are very proud of. And they run those cattle on an allotment of blasted Mojave Desert.
Cattle ranching in the Nevada desert is no easy task. Because vegetation is scarce, ranchers need to run cattle on vast tracts of land. Even a modest herd needs tens of thousands of acres. And in Nevada, they need to lease that land from the federal government. That's what Cliven Bundy, the patriarch of the Bundy family, did for years. Until 1990, when a reptile native to the area, the Mojave Desert tortoise, was listed as threatened.
Las Vegas was growing into habitat that was needed by the tortoises. Clark County wanted to allow for Las Vegas to continue to grow. And so an effort was made to persuade ranchers to get out of the business.
To give the tortoise more land without affecting the growth of Las Vegas, the BLM offered to buy ranchers out of their leases and put pressure on them to sell. Most of these ranchers were Mormons whose families had lived off the land for decades, some for centuries.
Of the, I believe, 55 largely Mormon ranchers who were operating then in Clark County, all but Cliven folded up and left.
As a protest, Bundy decided that not only would he not sell his lease, he wouldn't pay his grazing fees either.
Cliven decided, no, the government is trying to destroy my way of life. And what I'm going to do is just say, I'm not playing ball at all. I'm not going to pay my grazing fees anymore. I'm just going to run my cattle and let's see what you do.
Cliven started what would become a decade-long tug of war with the BLM. He was cited time after time for grazing on federal land. He was sent bill after bill, racking up hundreds of thousands of dollars in fees and penalties. But he kept running his cattle. As time went on and the government made no move to arrest him, he felt even more emboldened. He felt that God was watching over him.
You can't understand his politics without understanding his very intense Mormon beliefs.
Mormons believe that the United States is a holy land given from God. Some, like Cliven Bundy, believe the Constitution was divinely inspired, God speaking through the founding fathers.
He believes the federal government isn't constitutionally allowed to own land. And the United States is a sort of divine creation, a potential Zion founded on this continent.
Put simply, Cliven Bundy didn't recognize the authority of the federal government. So for 20 years, he didn't pay his grazing fees. By 2014, the government said Bundy owed more than $1 million in fees and penalties. Over the years, the BLM warned it would seize his cattle if he didn't pay up. The government was afraid of bloodshed, so that hadn't come to pass yet.
At some point, the BLM decided, hey, this is literally open defiance of the federal government. This has to end.
In some ways, Cliven Bundy was in the same hot water that Randy Weaver found himself in at Ruby Ridge. The federal government can't allow defiance indefinitely, and it doesn't forget. In March of 2014, two BLM special agents arrived at the Bundy Ranch. They told Cliven Bundy enough was enough. They were going to round up his cattle. The meeting didn't go well. The BLM knew that they were in for some trouble because of what they knew about Cliven's son, Ryan.
Ryan Bundy is a very, very tough character. His face is partially paralyzed because he was hit by a truck when he was very young and it tore off part of his face and he had to get it reattached. Ryan will say things that if you're around him, get you a little worried. He'll be like, it's going to get ugly.
Later that day, BLM agents reached out to Ryan Bundy to gauge how he was feeling about the situation with his father's cattle.
We really want to know if we're going to have any type of physical problems with you guys because we want to avoid that at all costs.
I'll tell you the best way to avoid that is to start adhering to the Constitution, recognize that there are rights here that you are violating, and simply do not show up.
Well, I have to be honest, and I have to inform you that's not an option.
10 days later, the BLM began to move in with force. It brought in cowboys to round up the cattle, along with agents with assault rifles and tactical gear. They anticipated that it would take weeks to round up the roughly 900-head herd of Bundy cattle scattered across the rangeland. And on April 5th, while agents kept a watchful eye on the Bundys, the roundup began. But the Bundys were also watching the BLM. On day two of the roundup, another of Cliven's sons, Dave, was taking pictures of the BLM effort.
Sir?
When he was approached and surrounded by agents with police dogs, he refused to leave. Ryan Bundy pulled up in a van moments later to help his brother.
Could you please leave?
I will. I am going to leave.
Okay, now.
But I cannot leave without
you. Okay, he's a grown man.
Ryan refused to leave without his brother. Moments later, Dave Bundy is tased and tackled by a group of agents.
It's your first choice, sir. To leave, okay? I'm going to drag you out of the car, okay? Here in a second.
With the tension rising, Ryan Bundy drives off as his brother Dave is arrested.
I am leaving. I'm in the process
okay.
of leaving.
Go to the speed limit.
After that, the Bundys put out a call to arms. They wanted all Patriot militias who could manage to come to the ranch to take a stand against the U.S. government.
The Bundys claim that they called in the militia as essentially self-defense, trying to prevent another Waco. Scores upon scores of people who openly identified as militiamen came to help them.
Today, protesters from as far away as Florida came to this stretch of desert road. Many are armed. Supporters who have driven from West Virginia, Pennsylvania, so many different...
The militia started to trickle in from everywhere, heavily armed and battle ready. Like the three percenters from Idaho, who years later would participate in the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. As supporters and militia gathered at the roadside by the Bundy Ranch, the tension rose.
Some of them say they are willing to die for the cause.
We will all die right here in place to defend the Bundys and the freedom of this country.
And to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
2 miles down the road from the Bundy Ranch, a neighbor allowed the group of supporters to gather on his land. And there, they were addressed by another of Cliven's sons, Ammon Bundy.
My dad's asked that I conduct this meeting.
Ammon was living up in Idaho, running a trucking supply company.
And we...
Take your hat off.
No, I can't take my hat off.
He never raises his voice. He's a person who does not claim to be any kind of militia leader. He does not claim to be any kind of extremely tough militant guy.
I'm not a professional speaker or any of the sort, but...
He came down and despite never carrying a gun on the standoff, he assumed a very clear leadership position.
The overreaching federal government... is throughout all the states, and that's why we're here. And we're certainly making a statement, right? Yeah.
Ammon would make his first major statement against the government on April 9, 2014, 5 days into the standoff, when a column of BLM vehicles came down out of the hills, right near where the supporters were standing.
So we've got 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
As the long convoy continued 7. To pass by, the Bundy supporters tried to block it.
You know what? If they want a war, they're asking for it.
BLM agents with police dogs tried to push the crowd back. Clive and Bundy's sister, Margaret Houston, slipped past and attempted to block one of the passing trucks when she was grabbed from behind by a BLM agent and slung to the ground. Seeing what had happened to his aunt, an enraged Ammon Bundy moved towards the agents, yelling at them. They fired a taser at him, but he stayed standing even as he was jolted by the electricity. He ripped the prongs out of his shirt and ran at them again. They ultimately tased him 3 times, but he didn't go down. Meanwhile, the situation had turned chaotic. To avoid things turning lethal, the BLM stood down and drove away from the scene. Videos of that scene landed on YouTube quickly and hit the militia movement like a lightning strike in a dry forest. They racked up over 1 million views in just a couple of hours. And that was only the beginning.
And this is a Fox News alert. Tensions are flaring in the standoff between Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy and
the federal government persecuting Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy.
Battling local rancher Cliven Bundy.
Always with its finger on the pulse of white middle America, Fox News brought the story to its millions of viewers in breathless terms.
Bundy supporters confronted the heavily armed federal officials.
Why are they harassing this man? The government is trying to control thought. It's trying to control speech.
Watching Fox News, you might take away that the government was trying to steal Bundy's land from him. You might forget that Bundy was only leasing the land from the American people and hadn't paid his grazing fees in decades.
They tased his son. They knocked down his sister to protect desert tortoise.
Said, no, you have to protect the turtles. You have to.
We're going to have armed agents shut down the factor because we're scaring the tortoises.
In the spin of the right-wing news ecosystem, the Bundy standoff was starting to be about something much bigger than delinquent fees or the Mojave Desert tortoise. It was seen as a government attack on traditional American life.
Is this man not part of the United States of America? The federal government works for the American people.
Back at the ranch, more and more people and more militias were showing up to support the Bundys. The Oath Keepers, the group that we mentioned in the last episode that had formed in the wake of Obama's election, showed up the day after the BLM clash. They were fronted by their leader, Stuart Rhodes, who called for more militias to come out.
Now look, guys. I'm talking to all the rest of the guys across the country. What's your excuse for sitting on your couch? What's your excuse for sitting on your balls and not coming up here and doing your duty?
It was the first big outing for a scene that's all too familiar now. White men in tactical gear with long guns. We'd see these same groups in Charlottesville protecting Nazis, occupying government buildings in Michigan during COVID lockdown protests. And finally, we would see Stuart Rhodes himself, along with other far-right groups, leading the charge on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. This moment at the Bundy Ranch was starting to become a watershed for the U.S. government, too. Would it stand up to this show of force and risk another bloody standoff? Or would it stand down? The protest camp had swelled from hundreds to thousands. The FBI warned that this was the largest militia gathering they'd ever seen, and all the media attention had undermined the cattle roundup. The auction house that had agreed to sell off the Bundy livestock backed out, and suddenly the BLM command post was stuck with the 300 cattle it had rounded up so far. It seemed increasingly unlikely the agency would be able to complete its roundup safely, if it could complete it at all. On the morning of April 12, 2014, the local sheriff came to the Bundy camp with some good news. The BLM was making plans to back out.
Freedom!
Clive and Bundy had gotten what he wanted, but he decided to make one more impossible demand of the sheriff anyway.
Sheriff, this is what we the people are asking this morning. Disarm the Park Service.
He wanted the sheriff to seize the BLM's guns and demolish their local facilities, then return with the guns in 1 hour.
We want those arms delivered right here under these flags in 1 hour. Yeah! Thank you.
Unsurprisingly, the sheriff didn't make the deadline. At the 1 hour mark, Cliven told the crowd to head to a makeshift paddock under Interstate 15, where the BLM was holding his cattle.
Now, we're going to go and take our land back and declare freedom and liberty here in this land. Yeah! Okay.
With Cliven's son Ammon at the front, a group of supporters mounted up on horseback and rode toward the paddock. Some of them carried American flags, others militia flags. And everywhere, the yellow Gadsden flag fluttered. It had become a prominent symbol of the far right's fight against the government, a coiled rattlesnake in the center, atop the words, "Don't tread on me."
This is very serious stuff. We're going to go confront a federal tactical team of BLM officers who are carrying long guns in body armor. They look like they're getting ready to go into Kandahar.
James Pogue again. Soon the crowd was packed in under the highway overpass, yelling at BLM agents on the other side of the gate.
You're gonna have to arrest us all or shoot us all!
As the crowd approached, BLM agents leveled assault rifles at them. Here's one of them on body camera footage.
Are you fucking people stupid or what?
Behind the supporters, up on another overpass, a crowd had shut down I-15, and militia members had gathered there.
The Idaho 3%ers took over I-15 and established sniper positions on the highway, blocking a major American artery of traffic and commerce, and had higher ground looking down at this BLM tactical team.
On the other side, BLM agents scanned the growing crowd for guns.
Got it. There's no gun there. No gun.
Finally, one agent went to the gate to meet with Ammon Bundy.
You need to leave. He kind of ended up negotiating with this BLM tactical team leader named Dan Love, and basically telling Dan Love to leave.
With visions of Ruby Ridge and Waco in his mind, the BLM's acting deputy director called the scene with an order. Abandon the cattle. Abandon the scene. Evacuate now. And that's exactly what happened. The BLM literally backed down, backing carefully away from the angry crowd. Ryan Bundy stood up on the gate and yelled,
"The West has nailed them won!"
The West has now been won. The cattle were released and rounded up back to the ranch.
They got the cows back, and the cows are there to this day. This is, to me, like a hugely significant moment in American life where no shots were fired, no one died. But for the first time in, I can't even imagine how many years, you had an actual successful armed action against federal authority.
Clive and Bundy's long standoff with the federal government was over, at least for now. Some of the supporters and militia members remained near the Bundy Ranch for a while, rechristening their staging area Camp Liberty. Oath Keeper founder Stuart Rhodes saw the standoff as a huge victory.
The founders told us in their wisdom that we must be the militia, right? It is necessary for the security of a free state. And this was a first step. It was a watershed moment.
Rhodes was right. This was only the beginning of the militia movement as a sort of patriotic security force. A few months later, the owners of an Oregon gold mine called the Sugar Pine Mine received a letter from the BLM. Their mine had fallen out of compliance with BLM rules, and the owners were asked to make changes or risk being shut down. Instead, the owners put out a call for militia help.
And the Oath Keepers used this as test case number two to see what they could do.
Forward is recon. 1-2, overwatch.
The Oath Keepers set up defensive positions in the Oregon forest around the mine and much of the occupation was recorded by militiamen and uploaded to YouTube and Facebook.
They're going to hold security while we move, so right now we are security plus overwatch.
The Oath Keepers put out a call for more support. The three percenters and members of another militia group called the Pacific Patriots Network showed up.
Then what sort of it blew into was, you know, hundreds of people within a logistics base down by the interstate, foxholes dug, sniper positions, bulldozers, fortifications. It was really, really intense. And I managed to talk my way into that camp. The Sugar Pine standoff was a test case to see, hey, will the BLM be brave enough to come in and kill us? And in this case, as in 2014, they were not.
For their part, the BLM was just confused. Suddenly, there were hundreds of armed people in the woods, insisting on due process for the mine owners. But all the BLM had done was send a letter to the owners. They'd never had any plans to seize the mine or destroy its operations.
They're going to get due process. They were always going to get it. And we just want to move the situation forward peacefully.
The BLM scheduled an appeals hearing for the owners, which is likely what would have happened anyway. And the militias stood down and claimed victory.
Basically, what people figured out is that if you're willing to leverage the risk of prison or death, you can get a lot of stuff out of the state.
Around that time, Ammon Bundy, the rancher's son, had been traveling around to communities of the rural West, giving sermons about the limits of the federal government.
My family has been ranching in the Southern Nevada area for 137 years.
His favorite thing is to go around and kind of give these long presentations about why he believes the federal government isn't constitutionally allowed to own land and why the United States is a divine creation and how those two things tie together.
All of us have rights. We have God-given rights, but then we also can go out and get property rights. And
he likes to think of himself as a sort of quasi-spiritual teacher.
But if the courts will protect our rights, then we must unite together, like we did at the Bundy Ranch, and protect them ourselves.
Ammon didn't know it, but right at that moment, a situation similar to what had happened at the Bundy Ranch was unfolding in Harney County, Oregon. A massive, remote county made up mostly of desert, where three-quarters of the land is federally controlled, and where a ranching family known as the Hammonds, run by a father and son, Dwight and Stephen, had been feuding with the BLM for decades.
They had big fights over the expansion of what's known as the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge.
The Malheur Wildlife Refuge was a key resting spot for migratory birds.
This refuge would grow, and they would grow by buying out other ranchers around it. And this created a lot of resentment.
Like the Bundys, the Hammonds were holdouts. They sometimes ran their cattle on refuge land legally. They'd even been arrested for obstructing federal officials who were building a fence to keep their cattle out.
Stephen Hammond said he was going to cut off a BLM agent's head and shit down his neck or something.
In the early 2000s, the Hammonds set fires that burned hundreds of acres of federal land and even threatened the lives of BLM firefighters who had been camped in the brush fire's path.
And now, this isn't a totally crazy thing. You set fire to your own land to try to prevent it from being swept by a wildfire that might be coming in.
But the government argued that the fires had been set for nefarious reasons. And in 2012, the Hammonds were arrested and charged with arson. They pleaded guilty, and because of the new mandatory minimums for terrorism charges set in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing, they would serve at least 5 years in prison.
They were convicted, and a judge said, hey, this is crazy. These people don't deserve five-year mandatory minimums. We're not going to do this.
The judge gave the Hammonds a lighter sentence, but eventually the government appealed. And in late 2015, the Hammonds were told they would have to report to prison in the new year to begin five-year sentences. And that's when Ammon Bundy, fresh off his own standoff with the government, got wind of the whole ordeal. He went to Burns, Oregon, and began organizing in support of the Hammonds.
Ammon wanted to actually go to the gates of the prison and prevent the Hammonds from being sent into custody. That, of course, didn't happen.
Ammon opted for a more civil route. On January 2nd, 2016, he led a protest through the streets of Burns, and rallied in the parking lot of a Safeway grocery store.
And he stood up on a snowbank and said, hey, let's make it worth it having come up here.
Those who are ready to actually do something about it, I'm asking you to follow me and go to the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge.
Intoxicated by the success of winning an armed standoff against the federal government, the Bundy brothers decided to stare down the BLM again. Ammon's plan was to take over and occupy the wildlife refuge that had given the Hammonds such grief.
Which, of course, was pretty easy because it was essentially a small bunkhouse for firefighters and a small little research station. They rolled those 40 miles down and took it over and put out a call and said, this is what we're doing. Does anyone want to join us?
We're calling people to come out here and stand. We need you to bring your arms, and we need you to come to the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge.
More than a half dozen armed militias showed up, including the Oath Keepers and the Idaho Three Percenters. By the end of the first day, there were about 100 occupiers at the refuge. No one was really sure how to respond. The standoff in 2014 had ostensibly been a defensive measure on the part of the Bundys and the militias, but now they had seized federal property. This was an offensive measure, maybe even an insurrection. But the government reaction was muted. The FBI said it wasn't in any rush to dislodge the protesters and would establish contact and monitor the situation. Even the Hammonds released a statement distancing themselves from the occupation. 2 days after the takeover, they went ahead and reported to prison as scheduled. Thanks, but no thanks, they seemed to say. But Ammon Bundy and his occupiers pushed ahead. And as they squatted at the refuge, days turned into weeks.
I just drove down and showed up at the gate. I got there a night. There was a blizzard. It was really, really hard to see. There were floodlights everywhere. There was a weird drone flying through everywhere. And there was a rumor that the FBI was about to come in. So everyone was really edgy. They were getting ready to actually shoot. I ran into this fellow, Jason Patrick, who I had known from the Sugar Pine standoff. And he was like, hey, first of all, you're going to freeze if you stay out here. But second of all, this is just not a safe space to be in. So let's go back in behind the lines. He took me to the bunkhouse where there were a bunch of people and a bunch of guns stashed up. And then he was texting with Ammon and suggested that I go see Ammon. We kind of came to the little office building where they were holed up and knocked on the door. I later learned from Ammon's bodyguard that the idea had been if somebody actually jiggles the door, just shoot through it. And on the other side, Ammon's then bodyguard was sitting there with an AR-15, like ready to shoot if somebody came through the door. Ammon was sitting lounging in a chair without a gun. He's looking around and everyone else is like getting ready to go to war. And he goes, it's fun to live this way, isn't it? And that was my introduction to all of this.
Pogue would end up spending weeks with Ammon and the occupiers of the wildlife refuge.
During the day, it was very cold. It was very snowy. It's this beautiful landscape, purple mountains in the background, sagebrush, sage hens clucking around. And then night would descend and the paranoia would come and people would pray and people would be convinced that there was going to be death and prison in their futures and all this stuff. Ammon didn't really seem to care about that. Ammon was throughout all of this intensely relaxed. He believed very genuinely that he had God on his side, and that with God on his side, the feds couldn't touch him.
Ammon's end goal was to return all federal lands to the control of the people. Until then, he had no plans to end the occupation, and the feds didn't seem to be in a rush to end it either. Ammon would come and go from the refuge and give talks around town in Burns, always with his right-hand man in the operation. This guy, Lavoy Finicum.
It's not for your grandkids to do. It's not for your children to do. It's for you in this room to do now.
Lavoy was someone who very much believed that the cause of preserving this way of life was worth dying for.
I'm putting my life on the line. I'm putting my children's life on the line. If you're not ready, that is fine. But for me, myself, just Lavoy Finicum, I will stand.
I think I would be far from the only one who was pretty convinced that none of this was going to end without Lavoy dying.
On January 24th, Stuart Rhodes from the Oath Keepers, who had been staying in downtown Burns, called the occupation and told Lavoie Finicum that the FBI was readying for a raid. Locally, no one really supported the occupation. They were a nuisance, not a revolution. Rhodes suggested Finicum and the Bundys reach out to the sheriff in a neighboring county, one who was politically sympathetic and might be willing to harbor them. 2 days later, the leadership of the occupation set out to meet the sheriff. Finicum drove one of the vehicles carrying Ryan Bundy, another occupier named Shauna Cox, and a teenage girl from a Christian singing group. Ammon rode in another vehicle.
The feds, of course, got word of this, and they were very concerned. They wanted to make sure that this group of people did not get out of the county and get up to where a possibly sympathetic sheriff might help them. So they set up a roadblock. Ammon's vehicle pulled over and he was arrested peacefully. There wasn't really much bones about that.
The occupants of the other vehicle refused to get out. As Shauna Cox shot video on her cell phone, Lavoie Finicum egged the officers on.
I'm going to go meet the sheriff. You back down or you kill me now. Go ahead, put the bullet through me.
The group tries to decide what to do, give up or run.
It's a really, really intense moment with people who are literally at the moment deciding whether to live or die for a cause.
Well, if we duck and you drive, what are they going to do? Try to knock us out? How much further we got to go?
They took off.
Get down.
Then you duck down.
It was snowy and they raced around a few bends and eventually they came to another roadblock.
Hey, on.
Okay, so they're shooting.
Hey, on.
Lavoie veered off the road. Almost hit a couple of the people who were involved in the roadblock. Lavoie got out of the truck and started screaming, "You're gonna have to shoot me. You're gonna have to shoot me.
Go ahead, shoot me.
Damn, trying to."
Someone from the FBI fired shots into the vehicle. Lavoie began kind of like spinning around in weird ways, and his hands were up for a while, and something had gone kind of haywire in his brain. He seemed to reach across his body with his right hand and go for a pocket where there was a pistol there.
Damn it. Are they shooting him? Did I shoot him?
The teenage girl who was there was screaming.
Oh my God! Up. Stay down.
For a few tense minutes, the rest of the occupants of the truck were afraid to get out. The Oregon State Police fired tear gas rounds, and finally, they all got out of the truck and surrendered.
Hands up.
The boy's dead.
Shit. Okay, go.
The arrest of Ammon Bundy and the police killing of Lavoie Finicum signaled a spiritual end to the occupation at Malheur. But back at the refuge, those who remained were upset, afraid, and confused about what to do next.
There was a debate on the refuge about whether people were going to stay. And there was a lot of talk like, hey, this is the start of a much bigger conflict. The FBI said, hey, look, anyone who wants to come out peacefully, do so now. Some people were not even going to impede, this kind of thing. A lot of people quickly surrendered. A lot of people quickly melted away. And a few diehards stayed. They ended up holed up in a tent, huddled up, very cold, and the feds surrounded them. People were trying to talk them down. And finally, it was down to David Fry, mentally not all there, not really even sure what's going on.
Fry live-streamed the last hours of his occupation on YouTube.
He was going to kill himself, and he said, you know what?
If everybody says hallelujah, I'll come out.
I'll come out if all of you, the surrounding officers, shout hallelujah. And they did it. They shouted hallelujah.
You're saying hallelujah! I want to tell you, David. Keep walking, my friend. Hallelujah.
41 days after it began, the standoff at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge was finally over.
Ammon spent the next few years in various forms of pretrial detention. He was transferred to the jail in Portland, Oregon, and he, along with
other co-conspirators who were charged in the Malheur standoff got ready to face trial. I visited him there in the Portland jail downtown, and he was very relaxed. His beard was shaved. He lost a lot of weight. He was very confident they were going to be acquitted. And they went through the largest federal trial in Oregon history and won it handily. I think that shocked a lot of people. It was the result of a kind of federal tendency to overcharge people. They charged them with a federal insurrection charge. They charged Ammon with armed assault on a federal officer, which was tough to prove because Ammon never carried a gun. So the trial really didn't go well for the federal government, and everyone who went to trial ended up being acquitted.
After that, the Justice Department charged Ammon and the rest of the Bundys, along with some militia members, for their role in the 2014 standoff in Nevada.
They brought up this kind of defense of, hey, we were the people who were under attack. We were the people, we called in the militia because we were worried about what the federal government was going to do. We were worried that we were being targeted.
Over the course of the trial, the government's case fell apart. There were questions about a cover-up of key evidence, about the actions of federal informants in the standoffs, and other outright governmental misconduct. In the end, Ammon Bundy and his co-conspirators all walked free again.
And now Ammon is back living in Idaho, running for governor, doing his thing. It's a very interesting story because he can justifiably claim to have led two armed actions against the federal government and to have gotten away with them.
The Bundys, of course, became heroes of the far right. Lavoy Finicum, who died on the roadside in those Oregon woods, is considered a martyr. This group of Western ranchers accomplished something that no one on the far right had. They stood up to the U.S. government and won. But they weren't just heroes on the far right, because by the time the Bundys seized the Malheur Refuge, anti-government sentiment had gone mainstream.
These are the front lines in the battle for the future of our country!
The Tea Party had flourished during the Obama years, under what they perceived as Obama's tyranny. Many Americans no longer trusted the government, but they didn't want to overthrow it. They wanted to fill it with outsiders. And in 2015, their savior came down a golden escalator and declared his candidacy.
I am officially running for President of the United States, and we are going to make our country great again.
Donald Trump rode anti-government anger to the front of the pack and then the Republican nomination.
We are going to drain the swamp in Washington, D.C.
And just a few days after the Bundy trial in Oregon ended, America went to the polls and elected him President of the United States.
This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
But the carnage was only beginning. Trump was the leader the far-right movement had been waiting for.
Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!
And his election would spur an unprecedented rise in far-right terrorism and violence across the United States.
Two people are dead and another is in custody.
Several bombs sent to multiple locations.
There has been a shooting at a synagogue and there are multiple casualties.
That's on the next episode of Long Shadow, Rise of the American Far Right. To learn more about the Bundy standoff, please read James Pogue's book, Chosen Country, A Rebellion in the West. Long Shadow, Rise of the American Far Right is a co-production of Longlead and Campside Media. The show is produced by Ryan Swikert. Callie Hitchcock is our associate producer. Executive producers are John Patrick Pullen and Josh Dean, who also served as Long Shadow's story editors. Audience development by Heather Muse. Will DeGravio is our research assistant. Fact-checking by Rebecca Holland. Claire Mullen did the mix. Sound design by Ryan Swikert. Music by Blue Dot Sessions and APM. Cover art by Longlead's creative director, Sarah Rogers. A special thanks to Jennifer Bassett, who consulted on the podcast. Learn more about Longlead and subscribe to our newsletter at longlead.com. If you're enjoying the show, spread the word, and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find the show. I'm Garrett Graff, and thanks for listening.